Well, good morning. It is so uplifting to us for you to be here. And we hope and pray that as we study together and we worship together, we open God's Word and study it together, that you will be uplifted and built up as we study what God has revealed to us. This morning, we're going to talk about the grand deception. And our text for our study this morning will be Genesis chapter 27. And you might want to turn to that passage and follow along. We're going to spend a lot of time. We'll look at other passages in the Word of God that are relevant. But we're going to spend a lot of time in Genesis chapter 27. In Genesis 27, Isaac and Rebekah are central to our story in that chapter. Of course, Isaac was the son of Abraham and Sarah. That he was about 100 and she was about 90 when he was born. It was a miraculous birth. Abraham had sent his servant over to Haran, to Laban's house, to choose a wife for Isaac so that he wouldn't marry one of the women in the land of Canaan. And of course, he brought back Rebekah. It was love at first sight. But now they're elderly. They've had two sons together, twin sons, Esau and Jacob. Esau is the older of the two, maybe by a few minutes. But they were twin brothers. But now Isaac is old, and we're told that he's blind. He really can't see anything. But he believes it's time for him to pronounce blessings on his son. Well, we're told that Esau, when he was a man, became a hunter. But Jacob is described as a peaceful man living in tents. Isaac apparently was partial to Esau. He loved the venison that he would bring in, and he would fix him a savory dish, a spicy dish that he really enjoyed, and he tended to favor Esau. We're told that Rebekah was partial to Jacob. We could do a lesson on problems that it causes in families when parents can't be even-handed in the love that they have for their children. Certainly when Jacob was older and had his 12 sons and was partial to Joseph, problems came out of that. But there may have been a little friction in this family because the two parents sort of were partial to the two sons. But it all started in our story because Isaac is talking to Esau and he says, I want you to go out and hunt game. And when you've shot something, you bring it back, prepare that savory dish that I love so much using that game. Bring it to me, I'll eat it, and then at that time I will pronounce a blessing upon you. Well, Rebekah, his wife, overhears this conversation, and she begins to devise a plan or a scheme to procure the preferred blessing for her favorite son, Jacob. Now, we're not told why she did that. We're told back in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 23 that the angel of God told her that the older, she was still with child, both infants were still in her womb, and she was told that the older is going to serve the younger. That's what God had to say about it before they were even born. Was she thinking back to that and thinking, my son Jacob deserves this preeminent blessing? I don't know. It could be that Jacob had told her about Esau selling him his birthright. We're told about that in Genesis 25, 29 through 34. Esau had come in from the field. He was famished. Apparently, he hadn't had a very good hunting day that day. But he thought he was starving to death. Jacob had made some good smelling porridge or soup of some kind. And he demanded that Esau sell him his birthright before he gave him any to eat. Now, the New Testament tells us that Esau was a profane man. In other words, he put more value on one bowl of soup on a temporary basis than did on something of much more value, which was his birthright. But he sold Jacob his birthright. It could be that Jacob had told his mother about that. We don't know. Or it could be she just wanted the better blessing for Jacob simply because he was her favorite. We don't know what her motives were. But she devises a scheme. Now this was not just a private scheme on her part. It was a conspiracy. She gets with Jacob and says, we need to do something. Your father is about to bless Esau and you need the blessing. You deserve the blessing that he's about to give. And so here's my plan. And she devises this plan for Jacob. Of course, the goal of the plan is to deceive blind, poor old blind Isaac into thinking that he's talking to Esau when in fact he's talking to Jacob. That's her plan. And in order to do that, She tells Jacob to get some goat, to slaughter a goat, bring her the meat, and she would prepare this savory dish. She had been married to Isaac for a long time, no doubt. She knew exactly what the recipe was and what he loved. And so it must have been pretty spicy because he can't tell the difference between venison and goat's meat. So she prepares this same dish that he loves using goat meat instead of wild game. And Esau brings up an issue. He says, but I'm smooth skin and my brother Esau is a hairy man. And if my father touches me, he'll know the difference. And so she takes some of the goat's hair and she applies it to his hands and to his neck so that if Isaac touches him, it'll feel like Esau. She also gets some of Esau's clothing and puts it on Jacob so that if he gets close enough, he'll smell like the field. He'll smell like he's been out hunting. He'll smell like his brother Esau. And so she sends Jacob into his father Isaac in disguise with this savory dish. Now, I really think we need to look at the conversation and read the conversation in Genesis 27, beginning in verse 18, because the impact is greater. It always floors me when I read about this scheme and the things that Rebekah and Jacob do on this occasion. But beginning in verse 18, we're told, "Then he came to his father and said, 'My father.' And he said, 'Here I am. Who are you, my son?' And Jacob said to his father, 'I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Get up, please. Sit and eat of my game that you may bless me.' Isaac said to his son, 'How is it that you have it so quickly, my son?' And he said, 'Because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me.' Then Isaac said to Jacob, 'Please come close that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not.' So Jacob came close to Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, 'The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau.' He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, 'Are you really my son Esau?' And he said, 'I am.' So he said, 'Bring it to me and I will eat of my son's game that I may bless you.' And he brought it to him and he ate. And he also brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, 'Please come close and kiss me, my son.' So he came close and kissed him. And when he smelled the smell of his garments, he blessed him and said, 'See, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed.'" I mean, the lies just keep piling up. "Who are you, my son? I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me to do. How did you get it so quickly?" You know the true answer to that? "We went out and slaughtered a goat that was standing out back. I didn't have to go out and kill game." But no, he lies again. "You know, come here and eat the game that I prepared for you. I got it so quickly because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. Are you really my son Esau?" "I am," he says. Had to pull off the deception, and the lies were over and over and over. And as a result, Isaac was deceived into thinking that he was talking to Esau when he was actually talking to Jacob. Rebekah and Jacob were successful in their plan. Now, it's not long before the ruse is discovered. No sooner than Jacob had left after receiving the blessing, and we'll look at those in more detail in a moment. But Jacob leaves, Esau walks in, and he arrives with his savory dish. He finally went out and killed something. He slaughtered it, he prepared it, he's made this savory dish like his father loves. And he brings it in, and he says in verse 31, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me." Immediately, Isaac knows something's not right. Just got through blessing a young man. At the time, he thought it was Esau. "Who are you?" "I'm your oldest son, Esau. I've gone and done what you told me to do. I've brought your savory dish for you to eat." And we're told that Isaac trembled violently in the New American Standard Version. He knew what had happened. He knew that his younger son had lied to him, had deceived him, had pulled off a grand deception with a lot of effort, a lot of premeditation, a lot of props in order to pull off this deception. And he said he trembled violently. He says in verse 35, "Your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing." And of course, Esau is distraught. Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. So Esau lifted his voice and wept. He was devastated that he was supposed to receive this blessing, came in with this savory dish, found out his brother had lied, and Isaac had been the victim. Well, there's a lot of aftermath of this. Devastation to a family. A trust between a father, Isaac, and his son, Jacob, was gone. Isaac couldn't trust Jacob after lying to him like that. Esau resolved that when his father Isaac was dead, they would go through the normal mourning period, and then Jacob was a dead man. That was Esau's resolution. I don't know what kind of relationship Rebekah had with Esau before this, but I guarantee you she didn't have any kind of relationship with Esau after this. When she was sending Jacob away for his own safety, she told him, "Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day? If you stick around, Esau is going to kill you and I'll lose both sons. I won't have either one." Jacob had to flee to Haran, where his family, where Abraham was originally from, and lived in the household of Laban for, don't know exactly how long, 15, 20 years. It was a long time. Indefinite period of time as far as he knew. All he knew is if he went back home while Esau still intended to kill him, he was a dead man. Well, there's a premise I would like for us to discuss together for a few moments this morning. And I believe this is something that has been debated for centuries, as men have read the scriptures and read this story. But one premise is that this is a classic case of the ends justifying the means. This is a classic case of a deception being necessary to bring about Jacob's rightful blessing. That the behavior of Rebekah and Jacob on this occasion was simply part of God's providence. That God intended for them to carry out this deception so that Jacob would get the blessing that God intended for him in the first place. That's one premise, and some people believe that. But I don't think we have to guess about it. The scriptures teach principles that we can apply to this situation and determine, I believe, what the truth of the matter is. The first principle that I believe the scriptures teach that bear on this issue is, number one, the blessings of the patriarchs were prophecies from God. We've talked about this before. In fact, Alan just referred to Jacob's blessings that he pronounced on his 12 sons in Genesis chapter 49. And you can read through all of those, and what you'll find is that Jacob was, or Israel as God had changed his name to, was pronouncing things, future predictions of things that would happen to these men and their descendants. There's no way Jacob could have known those things unless God revealed it to him. And when you get to verse 9 and he starts talking to Judah, it becomes especially obvious. And we've looked at this in an earlier lesson, but he talks about the lion of Judah and the scepter not departing from Judah until Shiloh comes, and to him would be the obedience of the peoples, and he would tie his donkey's colt to a choice vine, and he washes his robes in the blood of the grapes, and it goes on and on. Messianic prophecies 4,000 years before, well, 2,000 years before Jesus came. There's no way Jacob knew those things. God was prophesying through him when he pronounced those blessings on his sons. And the same thing was true in the case of Isaac blessing his sons. Number two, when a prophet spoke for God, the message was always correct. I would direct your attention to Numbers chapter 22. When we get to Numbers chapter 22 in the narrative of the history of the Israelite people, they had been in Egyptian bondage. God had rescued them. They were now camping on the outskirts of Moab. Their reputation had preceded them, and the Moabites were terrified. They knew what the God of this people was capable of, and they didn't want to be destroyed by these Israelites. So the king of Moab gets in contact with a Gentile prophet of Jehovah God by the name of Balaam. And he calls him, and of course he sends lots of wealth ahead and says, "I'll give you all of this, but I need for you to curse these people, the Israelites, so they don't do my people any harm." Now, to Balaam's credit, He says, I'm a prophet of God, and you know what? If God tells me to curse the people of Israel, I'll curse them. If God tells me to bless the people of Israel, I'll bless them. You know what I pronounce? I pronounce exactly what God tells me. That's all I can tell you, and I'm warning you right up front. You can give me all of the gold and silver in your house, and it's not going to make any difference. If God won't curse them, I can't curse them. Now, the New Testament condemns Balaam for being a covetous man. And when I match up the condemnations of the New Testament with the story of the Old Testament, I have to conclude that Balaam wanted that money as he could taste it. He wanted that wealth from the king. He knew he couldn't get it unless God cursed the people of Israel. But look at how many times he tried. I lost count. There were four or five times that Balak kept offering sacrifices and then turning to Balaam and say, now curse the people, and instead he would bless the people. And say, what are you doing to me? Let's go someplace else and we're offering more sacrifices and maybe then you can curse the people of Israel then. And over and over and over again, Balaam does nothing but bless the people of Israel. You know why? That was God's will that Israel be blessed. And it didn't matter what the king of Moab thought, didn't matter what Balaam wished for because he wanted to get rich. God was going to say exactly what needed to be said about the Israelites. Didn't matter what the prophet thought. When a prophet spoke for God, the message was correct. Now, there were false prophets who lied because God didn't tell them anything. But when they got a message from God, it was correct and it was true. It was according to the will of God. Number three, personal misconceptions of the prophet had no bearing on the accuracy of the prophecy. Now, we've talked about, and Alan alluded to it this morning, we've talked about the fact that Jacob probably didn't have the foggiest idea what he was talking about in most of that messianic prophecy, but it didn't change the prophecy. God got it just right, whether he understood it or not. But if you look over in John chapter 11, Jesus is going around the city of Jerusalem and Judea and the countryside and Galilee, and he's preaching and teaching, and a lot of the preaching and teaching doesn't put the Jewish leaders in a good light. And as far as they're concerned, he may be causing them some political problems with Rome, and they've got to find some way to get rid of the problem. And Caiaphas, we're told, was the high priest that year, and he made the statement to his fellow Jewish leaders, it is expedient for you that one man die for the people. Now, you know what he was thinking? It's expedient that this guy die so he doesn't create political problems for us and we don't lose our place as leaders of this Jewish people. That's what he meant. You know what God meant? John said, because he was high priest, he was a prophet, and God was prophesying through him, God made sure he mouthed the words that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people. And you know what God meant? It's expedient that my son die for you people, for the sins you've committed. That's what God was thinking when Caiaphas said it. Caiaphas had no idea what he was talking about. He was an enemy of Jesus, and yet he prophesied truth because God put it in his mind. Caused it to come out of his mouth. The personal misconceptions of the prophet are irrelevant. When God prophesies, it's going to be true. Number four, God will accomplish his will regardless of what we do. Now, we're going to talk about that, and you need to understand what I mean by that. But I think it's interesting to look in Esther chapter 4, the entire book of Esther. And I've made this statement before. I've studied through it a number of times. I've never found any miracles in that book. It is all the providence of God, and I think that's the reason God gave it to us, to understand that he can work in the affairs of men without setting aside the laws of nature, and he can make things work the way he wants them to work by his providential care. But you recall Mordecai had a niece that he had raised. She was just a common Jewish girl, beautiful girl, but she becomes queen of King Ahasuerus. But now Haman, who was a wicked minister of the king, had tricked him into signing an edict that would turn out to be the destruction of the Jews everywhere. So Mordecai is trying to encourage his niece to take advantage of the influence that she has as queen to turn this situation around. But in Esther 4, beginning in verse 13, Mordecai says, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have attained royalty for such a time as this." Mordecai makes several points. He said, number one, if you think you're safe up in the palace, think again. You think people don't know you're Jewish? You think they don't know your background? You think Haman likes you? He has all these other Jews, starts killing all these other Jews. You're going to be first in line. You think you're safe in the palace? Number two, or I'm going to move the last one up to number two. Who knows whether you've attained to this position of royalty for this very reason? You're there for a purpose. You need to take advantage of the influence that God has arranged for you to have to save your people. You need to do that. But finally he says, you know what, if you decide to sit back silently, you'll be destroyed. Maybe some other Jews will be destroyed, but I'll tell you, relief and deliverance is going to arise for the Jews from somewhere. And if you don't do your job, God will have somebody else do it. When God decides, if God decided the Jewish people were to be delivered, you know what, the Jewish people are going to be delivered. It doesn't matter what Esther does. And I believe Mordecai was right. I think God put her in that position to use her to do what she needed to do to bring about his providential care for the Jewish people. My point is, I also believe Mordecai was dead on when he said if she chose to keep silent, God would find some way to get his will done through her, through someone else. Number five, sometimes God doesn't need our help. Now, you know, God doesn't come to John McKee in the still of the night and say, there's this project I've got going and this is your role in it. This is what I want you to do. So my will is to... Don't do that. He doesn't do that. I've got the teaching of the scriptures to guide me. I pray for wisdom so that hopefully I'll make the right decisions day to day and apply the principles of his word to my life. And when I see opportunities where I can be of some good, I do the good I can do. That's the best I can do. God doesn't tell me about his providential care. But frankly, God doesn't need our help sometimes. Sometimes we try too hard. Abraham needed an heir. Abraham is in his 90s. He's pushing 100. And he needs an heir. God told him, I'm going to make of you a great nation. And you know what Abraham's response is before Ishmael's born? I've got this heir in my house. He's my servant, Eliezer of Damascus. He's a fine fellow. I love him to death. I love him like a son. And I don't have any kids. And when I die, I was just planning on leaving everything to Eliezer. And you know what God said? I don't need Eliezer. And then Ishmael's born. Sarah says, here, I'm barren. Take my maid servant and she can be your wife or your concubine. And he has Ishmael by Hagar. And Abraham says to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. And you know what God said? I don't need Ishmael. It doesn't matter if you're 99 and she's 90. The two of you are going to have a child and I'm going to make of you a great nation through Isaac, your son. Sometimes we try to help too much, and especially we don't need to be doing things that are wrong in an effort to try to come out with some end result that we think is good. Now let's fast forward quite a few years. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 48. Now Jacob is the old man. Jacob's not a young man getting a blessing from his aged blind father. Now he's the aged blind father. And he has 12 sons, and one of his sons is number two behind Pharaoh down in Egypt. They're all living down in Goshen in the land of Egypt, been blessed down there. And now Jacob is old, and so Joseph finds out that his father is ill. So he brings his two sons that he had in Egypt by the wife that Pharaoh had given him, Ephraim and Manasseh. He brings his two sons down to visit with his ailing father, Jacob. Now Jacob decides to bless Ephraim and Manasseh, and the strangest thing happens. We're told in Genesis 48, beginning in verse 13, Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right, they're facing him, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. Manasseh's the oldest. Joseph has intentionally positioned Manasseh at Jacob's right hand, and he's positioned the younger Ephraim at Jacob's left hand. And lo and behold, Jacob gets ready to bless these two boys. He's blind as he can see. He can't even see the boys. And he reaches his right hand over and puts it on Ephraim's head. He reaches his left hand over and puts it on Manasseh's head. And he starts to bless these boys. And we're told down in verse 17, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head. And you can just see it. You know, he's like this, and he's grabbing his hand off of Ephraim's head, and he said, "No, my father." He's trying to pull it over to Manasseh's head, and this old man is fighting with all his might to keep his hands where they belong, and says, "No, I'm doing what I'm doing for a reason." Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. I may be blind, but I know what I'm doing. He also will become a people, and he also will be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." Wow, isn't that fascinating? Same man, same Jacob. He's learned a lot. Of course, it's by the inspiration of God. The Spirit is guiding him. But how much help did God need to do the right thing with Ephraim and Manasseh? You know, Joseph tried his best to get the right boy lined up with the right hand, so he thought he knew how things ought to be. When God took control, when God decided who was going to get what blessing, he did exactly what he wanted to do. He didn't need any help. Now, rewind back to Isaac blessing Esau and Jacob, and you tell me how much help does God need? There were two blessings pronounced. Let's look at these blessings real quickly. The first blessing that Isaac pronounced, "Now may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and abundance of grain and new wine. May people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you." That was one blessing. That was the first one he gave. When Esau said, "Oh, my father, can't you give me a blessing?" It's not much of a blessing, but such as it is, he said, "Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, and away from the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But it shall come about when you become restless that you will break his yoke from your neck." Now here's two blessings, and my question is, which blessing belonged to who? That's really the question. The scripture reading this morning was Romans chapter 9, verses 10 through 13. Paul is saying, you know what, when Rebekah was still pregnant, God decided, but among these two twins, that the older was going to serve the younger. And you know what Paul emphasized? Had nothing to do with good or bad. Nobody had done anything. It wasn't like one boy was good and the other was bad. Neither one of them had ever done anything good or bad. They were still infants. They were still in the womb. They haven't done anything. But when God said the older is going to serve the younger, that's his prerogative. And that's Paul's whole point in Romans chapter 9. It's none of my business. It's none of your business. It was none of Esau's business. God decided. It's decided. That's the way it is. And he doesn't have to defend himself to me or anybody else. Isaac, Esau, he doesn't owe anybody anything. When Isaac said to Esau, "Your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing," you know what? Isaac was dead wrong. Jacob didn't steal Esau's blessing. Jacob got Jacob's blessing, right? That was God intended that from the beginning. They were blessings from the womb. And the first blessing was Jacob's blessing. It didn't matter what misconception Isaac had in his mind. It's irrelevant. God proclaimed the blessing on Jacob, the blessing that Jacob should have gotten. Didn't matter whether he showed up first, whether he showed up second. Now the question is, and the question behind this whole debate over the century is, what would have happened if Rebekah and Jacob hadn't done what they did? I mean, this was disgusting, folks. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. And if one of my children ever did me that way, I'd be devastated. I can't imagine a son and a wife trying to deceive an elderly gentleman like that. It was horrible. And the question, what would happen if they hadn't done that? What would happen if Rebekah, when she overheard this conversation, had gone back to her tent and prayed to God and said, "God, you remember that promise you made before they were born? God never resented someone praying and saying, remember what you promised. Remember what you promised. Abraham did it. Moses did it. They all did it. And God never got angry. Rebecca could go on back to her tent and said, God, remember what you promised me? I trust you to take care of this. What if she had done that? Well, my position is that Jacob would have received Jacob's blessing and Esau would have received Esau's blessing. Why would we assume anything else? You think God was hogtied by some misconceptions that Isaac had? It was irrelevant. God had already decided before they were born who was going to give which blessing, and the actions of Rebekah and Jacob really had nothing to do with it. Well, what about it? It was shameful. It demonstrated a lack of faith in God to carry out what he promised before they were born, and it tore the family apart. Well, if we look at the rest of the story real quickly, Jacob, of course, lived in Haran. I put 14 plus years. He served for Leah for 7 and Rebecca for 7. So, you know, as he was there and he raised a family, he became wealthy. It could have been 20 years. I don't know, but he was there for a long time. Esau became wealthy, and when Jacob came back, rather than trying to kill him, he forgave Jacob, and they were reconciled. In fact, they buried their father Isaac together. Esau became the father of the Edomites, and Jacob became older, not just older, but wiser. And you can see that in his blessing on Ephraim and Manasseh. Well, there are several lessons, I think, for us. We need to be sensitive to our role in God's providence. And again, he's not going to talk to you in a still, small voice in the night and say, here's something I need for you to do for me to make my plan work out. But we need to understand what God's will is for us by studying the Scriptures and to be sensitive to opportunities out there to help others, to teach others, to be there when God needs us, to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We need to be sensitive to that. The ends don't justify the means. In Romans chapter 3 and verse 8, Paul said, there are people who are slanderously reporting that I'm going around saying, let us do evil that good may come. And Paul said, I'm not teaching that at all. You don't go do evil that good may come. It's not taught. And if you want to try to justify that, don't go back to Rebekah and Jacob. It's a poor example. God didn't need their help. And then number 3, God has a plan, and he's going to accomplish his will. We have to trust him. We have to have faith in him. Why did he choose Abraham and not Haran? I don't know. Who knows? Why did he choose Isaac and not Ishmael? Why did he choose Jacob and not Esau? Why did he choose Judah and not one of the other 11? Why did he choose David and when he had, 7 older brothers? I don't remember. I had to go back and read it. But he had a lot of older brothers. He chose the youngest one to be the head of a dynasty of kings. Why did he choose Solomon when Adonijah was the oldest, older than Solomon? I'll tell you, it's because God said that's the way it's going to be. It's his will, and that's the way it's going to come out. And that's exactly what happened. God's going to accomplish his will for us. He operates in the affairs of men, even in an age when miracles have gone by the wayside. He makes all things work together for good to those who love him. We have to have faith in that. If you're here this morning, you're not a Christian. You ought to be. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the God that we serve today. He's the very same God. He's the one who was and who is to come. And he created you. He deserves to direct your life. And he's the only one that can save you from yourself, from the sins that you've committed. He loves you enough to have sent his son to pay the price for those sins. You need to obey the gospel this morning. You need to obey God and become one of his children. For those of us who are already Christians, I think this kind of study is important from time to time. And it helps us to understand who God is, helps us to understand what our relationship to our Father is. And the fact that he is King of kings and Lord of lords, he is in control, but he also loves us, he cares about us, and we can trust him to have our best interest at heart. If there's anyone who's subject to the invitation this morning, come forward and make that known while we stand together and sing.